All right, so we are going to finish up tonight in Ruth chapter 4. And I trust, because there's no one who looks really super depressed, that no one's read ahead, and that everybody is... Did you read ahead? Sadie read ahead because, well, she needed the practice. So we'll let her have the... We'll let her have a freebie since she needs to learn to read. So that's why. All right. So we are picking up here in the last chapter of the book of Ruth. And we come into this scene. We got into chapter 3, and this has just seemed like such a depressing story going into chapter 3. We saw this build-up coming, and in chapter 3, Naomi and Ruth devise a plan for finding a way to deal with a very potentially awkward situation, right? So we have an older gentleman, Boaz, who is at least a bachelor. Maybe he's a widower. All we know is that he's not married, right? He has no children, but we know that he is of a generation ahead of Ruth, but there is an affection between these two individuals. That has blossomed and has matured, but we can't get him to pull the trigger. Clearly, there were some signs there between these two, obvious enough that word has gotten back to Naomi through the grapevine of what is going on. I'm sure that she and Ruth had talked about it. And so finally, Naomi has to take the reins in this, and she says, okay, here's what we're going to do. He's not going to budge. There's no way for us to do this publicly without embarrassing him or without taking the risk of rejection on the part of Ruth. So she says, here's how we're going to go about this. And so she sends Ruth out in the midnight hour to meet with Boaz under cover of darkness and kind of nudge this thing along a little bit. And Naomi tells Ruth, go and lay down at his feet and he'll tell you what to do. But Ruth takes it a step further and she shows even more assertiveness in this. And when he wakes up and she says, what do you want? She says, I want you to spread your skirt over your handmaid, for thou art a near kinsman. And I'm not going to go into everything that goes into that verse. You can go back if you missed it and listen to last week. But there's no innuendo there. There's nothing implied there in the way that it says. It's just the word that they chose in this interpretation, in this translation. It could be wing as well. And so he praises her for choosing him, because she could have gone after younger men, both rich and poor, implying that there are other men who have shown interest in Ruth, but she has stayed true to him. And then he drops a bomb on us and lets us know and lets her know. And how she didn't know this, I'm not sure. But he says, I would love to marry you, but there is a nearer kinsman than me. And I've got to go and offer him the right of redemption first. So he sends her back home in the morning, and she goes back and she reports back to Naomi, and we end chapter 3 with Naomi telling her, sit still, my daughter, until thou know how the matter will fall, for the man will not be in rest until he has finished this thing this day. And so now we go with Boaz, and sure enough, he wastes no time. And in chapter 4, verse 1, Boaz goes up to the gate and he sits down. And behold, the kinsman of whom Boaz spake came by, unto whom he said, ho, such a one, which is what I'm going to start calling guys from now on, such a one, turn aside, sit down here. And he turned aside and he sat down. Now, why did they meet in the gate of the city? The gate of the city is not just like a big archway where you walk in. This is the seat of government. In these cities, this is where all of the elders would meet. This is essentially the bench outside the barbershop in small town Israel. Okay? This is where all the old men in the city come and sit every day, and this is where things get done. Business transactions take place here, handshakes take place here, contracts take place here. And so sure enough, Boaz sits down and he turns in. And it says that Boaz takes 10 men of the elders of the city, and he tells them, you sit down here. And so they sat down. And he said unto the kinsman, Naomi, that has come again out of the country of Moab, selleth a parcel of land, which was our brother Elimelech's. And I thought to advertise thee, saying, buy it before the inhabitants and before the elders of my people. If thou wilt redeem it, redeem it. But if thou wilt not redeem it, then tell me that I may know, for there is none to redeem it besides thee, and I am here after thee. And the other guy says, I will redeem it. That is not how scripts are supposed to be written. What the what? This is not how Hollywood goes, right? What's supposed to happen here is this guy is supposed to say, no, I'm not going to do this, but this guy is equally righteous. Boaz is righteous in bringing this knowledge to him. He doesn't want there to be any whispering. He doesn't want there to be anybody saying that there was a cheat here. He brings it to this man, and this man is equally honorable. And so he says, absolutely, I will buy it. I want to do what's right here. I want to take care of Naomi. Everybody in this story, from chapter 1 through chapter 4, wants to take care of Naomi. And this man is included in this. And so he says, I will absolutely redeem it and take care of her. Then says Boaz, what day thou buyest the field of the hand of Naomi, thou must buy it also of Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of the dead, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance. And the kinsman said, then I cannot redeem it for myself, lest I mar mine own inheritance. Redeem thou my right to thyself, for I cannot redeem it. So what changed here? See, when we're taking care of Naomi, this guy's all about it. He's all about honoring the dead, honoring Elimelech, taking care of his own, which is an honorable thing to do. But as soon as the context shifts, and now it also includes you're going to have to bring Ruth into this, the entire equation changes. Now, why is that? Well, what happens if he redeems Naomi? Is Naomi of childbearing years? No, she's not. In fact, that was a conversation that she had with Ruth and Orpah in chapter 1. So this man could have come in, bought this land from Naomi, given her a good price, taken care of her, done the honorable thing, and he would not have really, there would not have been any risk involved for him. He'd just been doing a good thing. But when Ruth comes into this equation, now it's actually going to cost him something in the long run. Because if he brings Ruth into his house, if he marries Ruth, now his descendants would have to share the inheritance. His descendants through Ruth would have to share the inheritance with any other descendants he may have. And it's fair to speculate that this gentleman probably already has children. So he could take Ruth to be an additional wife. That's completely legal at that time. He could have taken Ruth to be an additional wife. He could have raised up children to her, but they would not have been considered his children. They would have been considered Mahlon's children. And they would have split the inheritance, and his children, who he already has, would have had to divide with another person. He says, no, that's too much. That is too much. I cannot do that. And so there in front of all of these witnesses, he turns over his right to redeem to Boaz. And then we get a little detail here in 7 and 8. About how the customs back at that time were. Now, this was the manner in former time in Israel concerning redeeming and concerning changing, for to confirm all things. A man plucked off his shoe and gave it to his neighbor, and this was a testimony in Israel. Therefore, the kinsman said to Boaz, buy it for thee, and so he drew off his shoe. I don't know why. There's no theology here. There's no, don't try to read into this, the number 7. Forget it. It's just something that they did. Okay, so he takes off his shoe and he gives his shoe to Boaz. And Boaz takes it back to the house and nails it on the wall with all the other shoes he's collected of all the other contracts he's ever had. And I don't know how this guy gets another shoe. It doesn't matter. But Boaz has the shoe, so if at any point in time there's ever a dispute about who said what, Boaz shows back up and he says, "Nope, I got the shoe." This is how we know. Now if you'll remember, in chapter 1, we were talking about this idea of the Redeemer, and we went back and we looked at that scripture in Leviticus and in Deuteronomy, and if someone had the privilege of being the Redeemer and they did not take it and they left a woman destitute, what did she do? She took his shoe and she spit in his face, right? And so there would have been a record even then that you had a chance to redeem, you had a chance to do what was right, and you didn't do it. So this is a consistent thing that they do amongst all these contracts and these decisions. And so Boaz says unto the elders and to all the people, "You are witnesses this day that I have bought all that was Elimelech's and all that was Chilion's and all that was Mahlon's of the hand of Naomi. Moreover, Ruth the Moabitess, the wife of Mahlon, have I purchased to be my wife, to raise up the name of the dead upon his inheritance, that the name of the dead is not cut off from among his brethren and from the gate of his place. Ye are witnesses this day." And now look at what the people say in return. "And all the people that were in the gate and the elders said, 'We are witnesses.'" Now look at this blessing that they ask for on behalf of Ruth. "The Lord make the woman that is come into thy house like Rachel and like Leah, which too did build the house of Israel, and do thou worthily in Ephraim to be famous in Bethlehem. And let thy house be like the house of Phares, whom Tamar bare to Judah, of the seed which the Lord shall give thee of this young woman." Remember what I said when we were going through chapter 2. You have to pay attention to every detail the writer includes. Why, of all people, would the author include Rachel and Leah, and even more importantly, Tamar? Now, most of you probably do not know the story of Tamar. Tamar was the daughter-in-law of Judah. This is in Genesis 36. Tamar was the daughter-in-law of Judah. And Tamar's husband died. And so what was supposed to happen? Her husband died and they had no children. His brother was supposed to take her to be a wife and raise up kids. Well, he did not want to do that, and so he short-circuited it a little bit, and God cursed him and he died. And so Judah now has lost his two oldest sons. He has one other son. And he says, "I'm not about to give my youngest son to be her husband." So he promises her, "Give him time to grow up, and then you guys will marry." Well, when he came of age, Judah just kind of blew her off. So she goes out and sits down, she dresses herself up. I'm going to use biblical words here. She dresses herself up like a harlot, and she goes out and sits down by the road and completely covers herself. And as Judah is going up to shear sheep, she allures him off of the road. And she asks a reward from him when everything is said and done, when all business transactions have been taken, and he gives her earrings and bracelets. And turns out she gets pregnant. And so Judah hears that his harlot of a daughter-in-law is pregnant. And he says, "I want her in here now. We're going to kill her. She will be stoned. She has committed adultery. She has embarrassed my family. And she will pay." And they go and get her, and she comes in. And he says, "I want to know who the guy was." And she says, "The guy that gave me these bracelets and earrings." And Judah says, "I have sinned against God, and I betrayed what you said. You are more righteous than me, even in your sin, and you will now come into my house." Why would they want Ruth to be like that? Well, what happens if, remember that Rachel and Leah, what was Rachel when she and Jacob first got married? She was barren. What's Ruth? How long was she and Malon married? 10 years. She got any kids? So the story's not over. Because even though Boaz has married her, there's still no kids. So they've blessed her and said, be like Rachel. What happened after Leah began to make fun of Rachel? God cursed her womb and she became barren. So you've got Rachel who was barren, you have Leah who was barren, you have Tamar who was barren, and all three of these women, God opens their womb at the exact right time for something to happen. And so they're praying this blessing on Ruth that God will open her womb that has been closed up to this point. Because this, it doesn't matter if Boaz marries Ruth and redeems Naomi, if they don't have children, we're going to be right back in the same boat we were in when Boaz dies. So they're praying a blessing on Ruth that he will please open her womb. Otherwise, there's no good in this redemption. So Boaz took Ruth, and she and his wife. The other reason for the blessing on Tamar of the house of Phares, guess where all of these people in the story came from? They're all descendants of Phares. So if there ain't no Tamar, and there ain't no Phares, there ain't no Elimelech, there ain't no Boaz, there ain't no Naomi, there ain't no Ruth, there ain't no anybody else, all the way down to Jesus, by the way. Jesus comes out of the house of Phares. Same as everybody else in this story. So Boaz took Ruth, and she was his wife. And when he went into her, the Lord gave her conception, and she bare a son. And now here's where it gets really crazy. We don't hear another word about Ruth for the rest of this story. And the women said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord which hath not left thee this day without a kinsman, that his name may be famous in Israel. And he shall be unto thee a restorer of thy life and a nourisher of thy old age. For thy daughter-in-law, which loveth thee, which is better to thee than 7 sons, hath borne him. So who's the Redeemer? Is the Redeemer Boaz? No. Because there still wasn't a line. There still wasn't a perpetual legacy until this baby is born. So now when the baby is born and the line is definitely going to continue, now the people say, bless you, Naomi. Not bless you, Ruth. And he shall be to thee a restorer of life and a nourisher of thine old age. Bless you, Naomi. Why? Why is the focus on Naomi? I told you on the very first week, on week one, the title of this book is not accurate. This story is not about Ruth. This whole story from chapter 1 to chapter 4 is about Naomi. She's the focus. Ruth is simply the vehicle for bringing about the blessing of Naomi. She's just the object in here. The subject is Naomi. And please don't get twisted up saying, Justin, how dare you say a book of the Bible is inaccurately named? Let me just point out real quick that 2 Samuel is all about David. In fact, Samuel dies in chapter 22 of 1 Samuel. Yet there's still a 2 Samuel. So there's a lot of places in the Bible where a book is named such and such, but it didn't have a lick to do with what the name of the book is. Okay, so this is another case of that, where the whole purpose of this book, it's great that Ruth is brought into the family of God. It's great that she is blessed and she is not left in pagan Moab. But the whole point of the entire story is Naomi. Going all the way back to chapter 1, verse 21, when Naomi says, I went out full, and the Lord hath brought me home again empty. Why then call ye me Naomi, seeing the Lord has testified against me, and the Almighty has afflicted me? And then you fast forward to chapter 4, And verse 14, and the women said to Naomi, blessed be the Lord which hath not left thee this day without a kinsman, that his name may be famous in Israel. And you skip down to 16, and Naomi took the child and laid it in her bosom and became nurse unto it. And the women, her neighbors, gave it a name, saying, there is born to Naomi. And they called his name Obed. And Obed means worship or to serve. He is the father of Jesse, the father of David. Why does this story matter? In the middle of all of this calamity and Judges, why does this story come up? Why is this even here, this little vignette about restoration and redemption? Because now we realize that if there is no Ruth, if there is no death of Elimelech, if there is no death of Mahlon, if there is no death of Chilion, there is no David. And if there is no David, there is no Jesus. But we look at this story, we read this story, and we see that there is eternal, perpetual hope in the sovereignty of God. He knows all things. He knew, going backwards three generations, he knew that there would be a young woman of ill repute in a pagan city living in the wall of that city, and that that young woman would someday have a knock at her door and two men would be standing on the side and they would say, hide us. And she did. And because of her faithfulness to hide them in the city of Jericho, Rahab the harlot and her whole household were delivered. Where did she live? In the wall. What happened to the wall? It crumbled, except for one spot. I don't know how it worked. I'd have loved to have seen it. The entire wall of Jericho. I mean, imagine. Imagine the Twin Towers collapse and there's one office that is completely unscathed. How does that happen? But it did. And it was Rahab. And Rahab marries Salmon. And Salmon has, and Rahab have a child. And his name is Boaz. And Boaz, the son of a harlot, marries Boaz, the son of a harlot, the great-great-great-grandson of a harlot, marries a pagan. And out of this pagan, harlot, and harlot, three generations later comes David, out of whom comes the Messiah. Can Jesus redeem anybody? You better believe He can. You better believe He can. In the sovereignty of God, who watches over every one of these things. Even little tiny, insignificant families in little podunk, dot-on-the-map towns, God watches over every single one of them. I watched week before last. If you got Netflix, I encourage you, go to Netflix and go to the search and type in Billy Graham. There is a new documentary that's just come out on Netflix. It's about an hour long. Man, it is a great documentary on Billy Graham. Billy Graham, who was saved in the ministry of Mordecai Ham. And I went back to look this up because, you know, there's always some twists and turns on some of these things. Mordecai Ham was invited to, he didn't get saved at a Billy Sunday revival, but he was invited to preach by the organization near Charlotte, North Carolina that was started by Billy Sunday. So Billy Sunday starts this local men's ministry. This local men's ministry invites Mordecai Ham to come to Charlotte, North Carolina. And he comes and he preaches and Billy Graham gets saved. And Billy Sunday, who was a professional baseball player and a drunk, and a drop-dead alcoholic, got saved through an organization that was started by a guy named Chapman, Wilbur Chapman. And Wilbur Chapman was a associate of D.L. Moody. And D.L. Moody was one of the greatest evangelists of the late 1800s who preached all over the United States and all over Europe. And D.L. Moody, Dwight Lyman Moody, came to Christ because a guy named Kimball, Edward Kimball, a shoe salesman, got convicted because Dwight L. Moody was sitting in his Sunday school class. Kincaid, thank you. Did I say Kimball? Yeah, Kincaid. Edward Kincaid was sitting, he was convicted about this young man that had been sitting in Sunday school class. And so he's walking by a shoe store one day, and he knew the young man worked in the shoe store. And he walked by it, and he said, "No, I got to go talk to him." And he goes back in, and he opens the door, and he goes in, and he says, "Dwight, we've got to sit down and talk." And he witnessed to Dwight, and Dwight got saved. And Dwight went on to be one of the greatest evangelists of all time. And one of his associates, Mr. Chapman, is having a meeting, a revival meeting. And in that revival meeting, Billy Sunday, who is an alcoholic former baseball player, gets saved. And Billy Sunday goes all over the United States preaching the gospel of Christ. And in one of those places is Charlotte, North Carolina, where he starts a local men's Bible study. And years later, that local men's Bible study invites a man named Mordecai Ham to come and to preach revival there. And while Mordecai Ham is there preaching revival, a young man goes up and gets saved, and his name is Billy Graham. And all the way back in a shoe store in Chicago, 60 years earlier, God's watching over that same conversation that led to 70 million people hearing the gospel through Billy Graham. Every bit of it. God's watching over all of it. God's watching over everything that's happening in here. Is it important that she's sitting here on the front row tonight? It absolutely is important. It's critical that Sadie's sitting here. We talked about it before. There's a likelihood that Georgie is going to see the next century. She'll live long enough to live in the next century. Is it important that she's sitting back right now? And in a way that I can actually see her whole body and not just her head. I didn't even know the child existed, but over her shoulders. Right? Is it important that she's sitting here? It's critical. Because we have no idea what's going to hold out. These people watching Naomi's life, they have no clue. They have no idea how this is going to turn out. And so they're praying that this Redeemer that is born through Ruth to redeem Naomi is famous in Israel. Do you think he ended up being famous in Israel? Yeah, I think so. Because when you read this story, so help me, trust me, 40 years from now, you'll remember the name Obed. Because you'll remember the name Jesse. Because you'll remember the name David. And you'll remember David because you'll remember Jesus. O thou son of David. And God watches over every bit of this throughout all of it. And it is such an encouragement to go in and read these four simple chapters and see the hand of God in everything that is done here throughout. Oh, shucks, I'm going to come up just short. 27 minutes and 28 minutes.